From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. It's August, and you're pining for the midwinter wonderments of the Super Bowl, right? Well, find no further, because just ahead on this best-of edition of Only a Game, we'll talk with two music experts about the fight songs of Super Bowl 43. Also, Trinity College's amazing squash title run and the second annual Plumbers Olympics. Also ahead, the eternal conflict between humans and zombies spills over onto the nation's college campuses. Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. In June of 2009, workers constructing a road that will carry visitors to the 2012 Olympic Games in London uncovered what appeared to be a mass grave. It was speculated that the bones found therein may be those of Britons dismembered and beheaded when soldiers of faraway Rome overran the land in about 43 AD. Though foul play is a near certainty, officials in Great Britain have said there is no reason to delay Olympics-related construction or improvements. And now, through the magic of radio, let us, you and I, leap forward in time to the 2012 Olympics in London, where a fun and festive time is no doubt being had by all. What the?
Nothing to see here. Move along.
What seems to be the problem?
Bit of confusion at the soccer stadium, Governor. Skies turned black, arms reaching up through the soil in the penalty box, grabbing some of the players, that sort of thing. Made a mess of the pitch it has. May not be enough boys left to finish the game.
Oh, the humanity!
Let's keep our wits about us, shall we? Nothing to be gained by panicking, I shouldn't think.
Good Lord, now what?
It's the Greek high jumper. Or it was. He ran down the thing there, launched himself into space, and now he's gone.
Rubbish.
Gone?
He never came down. It's as if he was swallowed up by the earth. This place is cursed.
Nothing to see here. Move along.
Nothing to see is right. He's just gone.
Not entirely as it happens. Look here.
Oh, my God! It's his head!
Put the bones back where you bloody found them, you kids.
It speaks!
Behave yourself, madam, or I'll have to ask you to leave the game.
You don't have to ask. I can't stay in this land of death. I'm out of here.
Where'd she go?
I'm sure she's fine. Probably off to see the aquatic events, I guess.
The water! The water in the pool! It's not water! It's red! It's bubbling up!
Can we get back to 2009? Cue the traveling music, please.
I now declare the 20th Olympic Summer Games closed.
Thank goodness. Do you suppose it's too late to consider relocating the 2012 Games to a site where nobody's discovered an ancient mass grave? What if the outcome of the Super Bowl didn't depend on time spent on the practice field or in the film room? What if the Super Bowl winner were determined by the music celebrating the team? Who would win? On the eve of Super Bowl XLIII, we asked the hosts of American Public Media's Sound Opinions to help us figure out which team would win the big game based solely on its fight songs. After we acknowledged that the Steelers were favored to win by a touchdown and that for every one Cardinals fight song the Steelers have about 10, Jim DeRogatis and Greg Kot were eager to get started.
Absolutely.
All right, we're going to start with Steelers Polka by Jimmy Sahulis, an oldie written for the 1978 team that beat the Cowboys in that Super Bowl. But the song, it seems to me, sounds much older.
We're from the town with the great football team. Cheer the Pittsburgh Steelers. Chuck Moll and all his friends are all on the beat. Go out and get them Steelers.
The tune isn't exactly original. It's based on the Pennsylvania polka, but it's catchy, right, and the lyrics seem to work. What do you think, guys?
You know, you got to be careful when you do polkas in front of Chicago, guys. I mean, we're talking about the biggest Polish population outside of Warsaw here, man.
It's true.
My parents have been dancing to polkas since they were born. They come from the old country. They settle in Chicago.
This just means you're qualified. You're ready to make a judgment.
He knows polka, and that is not good polka.
My parents would sit that one out. They'd sit that one out. They go, who is this guy?
It's an embarrassment.
This guy's no Jimmy Stir, I got to tell you.
No.
All right, well, moving right along, the Cardinals have only been in Arizona since 1988, but only a game's crack team of music researchers has found at least one song that dates from the team's days in St. Louis. The song was apparently written in 1960, but it can still be heard at home games. Here it is. A little bit of a predictable beginning to that one, but is it a worthy opponent for the Steeler song that we heard just before it?
I think so. I think that railroaded right over the Steelers. I mean,
they were in tune. That was a good thing.
At least when it comes to Super Bowl music, when it comes to football music, I think it's a mistake. You know, you get into trouble when you go with this newfangled pop stuff. You have MTV run the halftime show.
Yeah.
Next thing you know, you're staring at Janet Jackson's nipple, right? You know, it's like go with the old marching band thing. I mean, mm-hmm. that's perfectly mm-hmm. fine. You know, it's sort of sad that the Cardinals, when that song was written, they had to share it with the baseball team. It was the fight song for both the baseball team and the football team.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, it's a classic. You know, march around, get going.
I agree with you. The marching bands with the choreography where they'd make the designs on the field while they were playing, they need to bring that back.
And you got to love the tuba.
All right. So in the category of old-time fight song, clearly the winner is the Cardinals.
Yeah, give it to St. Louis.
Yeah. Okay.
They got the line game. It's all about the running game and the line play, right?
I don't know
what that means. I don't follow baseball, but...
Let's talk about songs adapted for use by football fans. Here we're going to put up a reworking of Pat Benatar's Heartbreaker by the Pop Rocks. This is a group of Steelers fans who just happen to be between the ages of 11 and 13. And then we're going to put up How About Them Cardinals by two Phoenix area DJs called Tim and Willie, which is based on George Strait's How About Them Cowgirls. So, first, the Pop Rocks. All right, and now the Pop Rock's more seasoned competition. We got Tim and Willie.
I think Kurt Warner is the league MVP. Then there's Darnell Dockett and DRC. Man, they play football. And all I can say is, how about them Cardinals?
Who's got the edge here? All right, the Young Rockers, who are, fittingly, from Harmony, Pennsylvania, or the older crooners from Arizona.
Oh, my God.
I don't know why you would cover George Strait and go for, like, bad Carpenters in Vegas cheese. You know, I think Tim and Willie blew it completely for St. Louis there. I admire the Pop Rocks. You know, I thought they were good. They got a violin. They got an electronic drum set. Mm-hmm. The YouTube video. At least they're not playing Guitar Hero.
You know, there was something less studied about her vocal. I mean, the guy who was doing the How About Them Cardinals song sounded so mannered. It sounded like one of those bad Glenn Frey solo records from the 80s. I mean, the phrasing was so stiff and so stilted. I mean, I give it to that 13-year-old girl. She had it all over her.
She had the spirit. I have a suspicion that like her dad wrote the song or something.
Yeah,
but I mean, you know,
right.
They were not great punk rock, but they were good.
All right, well, this is getting exciting because we've got ourselves a tie, and so we move into the final category. Finally, in the original song category, we have Road to Sixburg by Ryan Parker. This is a guy who's written songs about nearly every team in every city. So here we go.
It used to be Terry Bradshaw. Now these days it's Big Ben, who's making sure that the Steelers are gonna win it again. from Lynn Swan and John Stowart, right on down to Hinesville. The Steeler bus is still rolling with Mike Tomlin on board.
All right, the Sixburg in the title refers to a potential sixth Super Bowl title for the Steelers. Ryan Parker's up against a group called Golden Cousins, and they've got a song called We Do This Together.
You'll be hurting when Carlos and Burt give you the biz. Defense designed by Clancy and Coach Wiz. QBs on other teams, they're telling lay still, son. You just got hit by Adrian Wilson.
Yo, don't let your QB feel safe in the pocket. Kid, we keep making hits like Darnell Dockett. We in the bird's nest. All guests get scarred, plus a bunch of bird droppings on the visitors' cars. You can't stop the six.
All right, those songs are quite different, though perhaps equally hideous. They both employ excellent use of name dropping, I think. If you had to pick a winner, where would you go with this one?
Oh, my God, it's horrible. Do you remember the Super Bowl Shuffle? Again, a Chicago reference, because it reminds me, that Golden Cousins songs reminded me of the previously the worst song of all time.
Oh, it's
the
an
Super
embarrassment.
Bowl
that one's an embarrassment.
What
and the other one's
video.
No better, though. The other one stinks even worse. I mean, I like the kids, right, Greg?
Oh, are you talking about overall or between those two songs?
Yeah, well, yeah, it's the only thing we heard that has like a spark of like originality and just personality.
Well, spirit, yeah, personality.
Spirit. They got the attitude.
All right, so Heartbreaker by the Pop Rocks has kicked Pittsburgh over the top, according to my tally, and this is just fine. Have you guys a favorite among halftime performers?
I was big on Up With People. I think when Up With People did it, that was about the highlight of, and it's all been downhill since. It's a bad idea to, you know, I mean, essentially Springsteen is going to get 10 minutes of free advertising for this new album. Has nothing to do with anything.
Sure. You know, I think one of the most spectacular moments is when they went on this big PC kick after Nipplegate. They decided, okay, we're only going to get clean, wholesome entertainers now, and they got Prince.
Yeah,
I thought that's just genius. And then he did the little silhouette with the guitar and all that stuff, and you're going, wow, this is playing out to, you know, 100 million people across America.
It's go back to the marching bands. That's what we were saying before with the Cardinals fight song. It's like, you know, that's what belongs there.
Jim DeRogatis is a music critic at the Chicago Sun-Times, and Greg Kot writes about music for the Chicago Tribune. They host American Public Media's Sound Opinions, which they call the world's only rock and roll talk show. Jim and Greg, thank you very much for refereeing today.
Sure, it was a pleasure.
Our pleasure.
Palamalo. 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 Palamalo.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Kaká, the Brazilian player currently employed by powerhouse Real Madrid, is famous for knowing his way around the soccer pitch, but during the Brazilian team's recent visit to Tallinn for a friendly match against Estonia, he was less successful finding his way around town. Kaká decided to take an early morning walk around the city on his own, and when two police officers in a patrol car stopped to talk to him, the soccer star acknowledged that he was lost. The officers told him to hop into the car, and they obligingly took him back to his hotel, perhaps to the dismay of their countrymen in soccer shorts. I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, uncovering some big rackets in pre-war Germany. But first, skilled tradesmen are usually among the first to get pulled into the downward spiral in bad economic times. But a plumbing supplier in Sarasota is making the best of a bad situation with an annual athletic contest that brings the plumbing community together. Only a Game's Bobby O'Brien reports.
The sun is setting on this West Coast Florida community. Pink, orange, and purple streak the darkening sky. It's warm for January, shirt sleeve weather. Dozens of pickup trucks and service vans line a side street in South Sarasota, just off the interstate. It looks like an access road to the beach, but it's really an industrial warehouse complex. And tonight, a temporary athletic field.
And we're going to start first with putt-putt, and then we'll move on up to the horseshoes, the toilet seats.
Seth Coplin signals the start of the second annual Plumber Olympics. Coplin, who owns Plumbing Supplies and Specialties in Sarasota, created the games in 2008 to lift the spirits of plumbing contractors, his customers.
When we took over the business, the economy started to change. The first year we did this, we really started to see that a lot of plumbers were upset, tired, their morale was low, and we wanted to do something that could try to bring the community together and let them know that we're all in this together.
If morale was low in 2008, it's really tanked this year. That's all the more reason to repeat the games, though with a few cutbacks. Last year, attendees enjoyed a catered meal. This year, Seth's wife, Nancy, has cooked hamburgers and hot dogs for more than 50 plumbers and their families.
We were going to have this event, but we had to trim it. And so it was, what can we do? And I was back there with the food. I mean, we all had to kind of pitch in differently this year than we did last year, but that's okay. We do what we have to do.
That's when you grab an old blouse or two.
And even though the band plays a steady stream of blues, the mood is anything but sad, especially when the games start. The first event is a three-hole round of putt-putt, complete with artificial turf and obstacles like a three-inch pipe. The trick? Contestants have to do it using a putter of PVC pipe they make themselves.
You have to use at least three pieces of pipe. If your putter falls apart, it's a one-stroke penalty. If you bust, throw, or trash your putter, that's two strokes.
You got to have another joint in this thing somewhere.
Paul Higgins is a master plumber and owns his own business. He finishes the round in 10 strokes. Not a winning score, but that doesn't dampen his enthusiasm.
Plumbers, they help each other out, and it's a community of people, really is. Seth is great. He bought the place a couple of years ago, and ever since he's had the place, I mean, people owe him money, and he still lets them come in and buy, and he never bugs you. He understands what the economy's like, and he's a great guy. He really is.
Back on the course, the putt-putt contest ends in a tie, forcing a playoff. Charlie Stevens from Aqua Plumbing takes the putt-putt event. Next is the horseshoe toilet seat toss.
If you get a ringer, it's 5 points. Closest is 2 points. The one with the most points wins.
Elongated black toilet seats fly through the warm night breeze and land with thuds on the leaf-strewn side lawn of Seth's warehouse.
Oh! Hold on! Lightning ladies, I need you to be the judge of who's closer.
The horseshoe toilet seat toss is just, it's just funny. And the guys really like to do it. They really enjoy it, and it can get really competitive. This is a grown man throwing a toilet seat, and you would think that he's trying to win $1 million. It's hilarious.
Terry's Plumbing takes first in the toilet seat toss. Coplin says most plumbers have a great sense of humor, which is helpful, whether they're tossing a toilet seat or holding on as business goes down the drain. The next event is a more serious test of skill. It requires a hacksaw. The plumber must make 3 cuts within 5 inches of PVC pipe. The best time wins.
If you bleed, you lose. I don't want any blood on my pavement.
On your mark. Get set. Go.
Oh!
Headache!
Higgins Plumbing wins the pipe cutting contest with a time just over 10 seconds. So it comes down to the toilet paper toss to determine the winner of this year's championship trophy, which stands 4 feet high and is topped with a shiny gold-plated miniature outhouse. Some might consider the event silly, but Copeland says the event runs a little deeper than that.
This is what I think that other businesses need to be doing. You need to build a relationship with your customers because it's going to come down to a point of, you know, sometimes you're going to have to help them out, and you don't look at them just as numbers. You look at them as, okay, what have they done in the past? What can they do in the future? How can we work together to grow?
With that, Copeland gets called away to announce this year's winner.
It's with great honor that we present the 2009 Plumber Olympic Champion Trophy to Terry's Plumbing again. Back to back.
Even though this is a competitive event, plumbers like Paul Higgins say it's about something more important.
Stick it out, it's going to get better. As long as you got good friends, like, look, just look around. I mean, everybody's getting along. Everybody knows each other. As long as you got good friends and got people looking out for you and you're looking out for people, I think everything's going to be okay. We'll get through it.
For Only a Game, I'm Bobby O'Brien in Sarasota.
You know, just because they're the winners doesn't mean you guys can't keep on playing. If anybody wants to play any of the games, go right ahead. There's still some drinks, and thanks a lot for coming out.
In his book, A Terrible Splendor, Marshal John Fisher recreated the 1937 Davis Cup tennis match between Don Budge, who would become the most accomplished tennis player of his day, and Baron Gottfried von Kramm, twice the French Open champion, three times the Wimbledon runner-up. No less an authority than tennis great Bill Tilden called the 1937 match the greatest of all time. It occurred at Wimbledon as the German nation Kramm represented was about to plunge the world into war, having already begun to persecute Germans the Nazi regime regarded as inferior or morally deficient. In April of 2009, Marshal John Fisher joined me to discuss A Terrible Splendor, and I started by asking him to give our listeners some background information on Baron Gottfried von Kramm.
Any tennis fans in the 1930s certainly knew of him. He was probably the most popular player in the mid-1930s and clearly the number two player in the world for several years. Von Kramm was a German aristocrat who had grown up in a beautiful estate near Hanover and was just one of the great players of his time.
It's impossible to fully appreciate Gottfried von Kramm without understanding his commitment to sportsmanship. Please tell the story of his gesture at the point where the German team looked as if it might get further than they ever had before in Davis Cup competition, because that gesture certainly illustrates that commitment.
Yes, even at the time of when my book takes place, 1937, Germany still had never even reached the challenge round, which at that time the defending champion only had to play one match against the winner of all the challengers. So Germany several times had gotten to the what's called the interzone final, which is the last match before the challenge round. Mm-hmm. That's the match being played in my book. But 2 years before that, they were also playing against the Americans in the interzone final. It really came down to the doubles match, if you work it out. Clearly, at that time, von Kramm clearly was going to win his two singles matches. Davis Cup ties are the best of five matches. So if they won the doubles, they were certainly going to win and advance to the challenge round. And in that doubles match, von Kramm and his partner, he had a much weaker partner named Kai Lund, but von Kramm was playing so magnificently against the famous American team of Wilmer Allison and John Van Rijn that they reached match point five times. And this was a point that if they won would have given them match point.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly seemed they had won the point. The ball that the Americans hit went out. The umpire even declared point, and it was match point for Germany. But von Kramm calmly walked up to the umpire and quietly told him that the ball had tipped his racket and that they had, in fact, lost the point. And, you know, no one could believe it. But, of course, the German captain was enraged afterwards, but von Kramm calmly informed him that that's the way he had always played the game and that's the way he always would.
The subtitle of your book is Three Extraordinary Men, A World Poised for War and the Greatest Tennis Match Ever Played. The third of the extraordinary men, the first two being Don Budge and Gottfried von Kramm, is Bill Tilden. How did you decide to allow Tilden, who was helping to coach the German Davis Cup team in 1937, to become such a big part of your story?
Yeah, well, Bill Tilden is really the man who started this book off in my mind, because I was looking around for ideas and I thought about Bill Tilden, who was just a fascinating character. He was a homosexual at a time when no one could even talk about that. He rose to the tops not only of his profession, but really he was probably the most famous athlete in the world in the 1920s, or certainly one of the few most famous athletes. as I was looking into him, I discovered that Frank DeFord had written a wonderful biography of him. So what I had been thinking of doing, a biography of Tilden, that had already been done. But there was, but there was something I read in that bio that struck me, and it mentioned that he had been coaching the German Davis Cup team. And I had always read about the Budge von Kram match growing up playing tennis. You know, it was in all the books as one of the great matches of all time. But I had never known that Tilden had been coaching the Germans. And I thought, well, that's really interesting. You know, at that time, the Nazis were deporting homosexuals to the concentration camps and murdering them. And here they had as their coach an American homosexual. That was interesting. And then I started researching about von Kram, and he just became this incredibly fascinating character to me. And I started reading how that after this match, he had been imprisoned on what a lot of sources call trumped up charges of homosexuality. And as I researched him more, it became clear that he was a homosexual. They may have imprisoned him anyway, but they didn't have to make up these charges. Homosexuality was illegal. And, you know, von Kram was being held up as the great Aryan athlete. He was tall and handsome, blonde and blue-eyed, and the perfect German athlete. But in fact, he wasn't quite what the Nazis were portraying him as.
It certainly can be argued that von Kram was under more pressure than Don Budge was when they played that match. In fact, the German said to Bill Tilden at one point that he was playing for his life. Was that an overstatement?
Maybe not. In fact, as things turned out, it probably was not an overstatement. The Nazis had made it clear to him that they were following him. They had brought him in for questioning at least once to Gestapo headquarters. Several sources say that they had made it clear to him that as long as he kept winning, and certainly if he brought Germany the Davis Cup, they wouldn't bother him. I mean, I don't think they could have if Germany had won the Davis Cup. But that if he stopped being useful to them by winning, that he could be in trouble. Germany was not a safe place for homosexuals at that time.
The match ends with an exceptionally acrobatic return from Don Budge, a shot that von Kram could only watch as it went by him at the net. Please read the passage from your book that describes what happens after that final point.
For a second, the gallery can't believe the match is over. Then it explodes. The match had been, quote, something so close to art, in James Thurber's view, that at the end it was more as if a concert had ended than a tennis match. The shouts of bravo when it was over came out of an emotion usually reserved for something more important. Alistair Cook agrees, quote, and then a British crowd forgot its nature. It stood on benches and must have been aware that the deep kind of roar they were making does not belong on any tennis court. It has belonged outside Buckingham Palace the night war was declared. Ned Potter simply puts down some shorthand in his notebook. B for Budge, FH for forehand, pass, lovely. 7:23 p.m.
Marshall John Fisher is the author of A Terrible Splendor, Three Extraordinary Men, A World Poised for War, and The Greatest Tennis Match Ever Played. The book is published by Crown. Marshall John Fisher joined me from the studios of WAMC. Thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill. It was fun.
You're listening to Only a Game. Our games are many things to many people. For one of commentator Alyssa Eli's relatives, sports is a matter of life.
He's close to 100, my uncle. His hearing's acute, his prow teeth are his own, and his mind is sharper than yours. He lives on the top floor of a duplex where his TV, the great love left in his life, is always on. On this great love, he watches sports, only sports. Between innings or quarters or holes or sets, he limps down the hall to fix himself a milkshake. Sometimes he cooks himself a pot roast, but only when it's between games. In order to talk to him, I have to accommodate his tight schedule. I turn my television to his sports channel and then dial like the wind when commercials come on. Often the wind doesn't blow fast enough and I miss my opportunity. Some handsome man has just stopped shaving with his exceptional new razor, or some photogenic group has finished their delicious beers. "I'm in the middle of a game, honey," he says. "I'll call you back." But he never calls back because another game comes on afterwards. 99 has been an arduous age for him. This winter was almost impossible. The one friend he had left died. He fell once or twice, stepping out on his deck, and had to wait until a neighbor noticed the lights were off in the apartment before being rescued. He started medication for back pain and headaches. On the phone, he began to wonder about the sense of turning 100. I wondered, too. Last week, I called to ask about his health. "It's terrible," he said. "The doctor won't operate on his cataract, and his perfect teeth hurt. But it's also baseball season, which means 162 games. That's a lot of pot roast." "So, honey," he said, sounding more cheerful than I've heard in a while, "don't call me in the middle of any of them." Then he hung up on me because the commercial was over. Salvation is an individual process. Personally, I've always preferred documentaries when it comes to television. But I'm not sure they will keep a man alive.
Alyssa Eli is a psychiatrist living near Boston. You can take a closer listen to this week's stories, find a link to our weekly podcasts, or peruse our archives by visiting our website at onlyagame.org. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. And AVFX, Boston-based and serving the nation with audiovisual staging tools at corporate meetings, trade shows, and live events. Location information at avfx.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The tension was palpable at the recent 35th World Cocktail Championships in Berlin. The two-time German champion in the flair division of the competition, during which bartenders tossed bottles behind their backs like Tom Cruise and balanced said bottles on their noses, injured his shoulder warming up. But an Olympic trainer appeared to give Levant Yilmaz an injection, and he was able to compete. Unhappily for the German fans, Mr. Yilmaz was not able to win. He was outflared by Gianluigi Bosco, an Italian whose signature cocktail contained vodka, apple juice, mango puree, vanilla, and absolutely no Bosco at all.
Winding tulip was the cause of it all.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, zombies infiltrate the nation's colleges and universities. Oh, sure, like that's never happened before. But first, one of the prime gathering spots in the Ferris Athletic Center at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut, is a pyramid covered in brown carpet topped by an electronic scoreboard that doesn't work. From any of the pyramid's levels, on any of its three sides, a seated spectator can see at least a few of the courts where the Trinity men's squash team wins. The spectators have learned to expect the winning. In fact, the Trinity men's team wins so often that their coach, Paul Asiante, long ago began thinking about headier matters than mere results.
If you come with a goal in mind, just that goal, that actually holds you back. We try to play on a much more esoteric plane, which is we try to live with the awesome power of now. And we try to encourage these kids to come every day and to give 110%. And live that match, that practice, that classroom experience as if it were the last one of their lives. If you can get 22 kids doing that every time you come together, you create a maelstrom of energy that is almost, you know, you almost can't beat that.
Well, yeah, except for the almost, because in fact you can't beat that, and neither can anybody else. When I talked with Coach Asiante in January of 2009, the Trinity men's squash team had won 10 consecutive intercollegiate championships. A month later, the string was 11. Teams coming to Hartford to play them don't think of winning matches or even games. They aspire to capture the odd point.
Our practice matches are very often much more difficult and more challenging than our matches against other schools.
Part of the reason for Trinity's success, according to Coach Asiante, is diversity.
First of all, we have kids coming from 11 different countries, and each one of them came here thinking they were the center of their respective club, state, city, nation. You know, Basa Chowdhury was the number one junior in the world. So when they come here, they're individuals, and they're very prideful of their individual accomplishment. And we just completely break them down. We take them through a plebe experience, if you will.
Plebe as in West Point.
As in West Point, which is where I spent 11 years. And we teach them that we don't really care about your individual accomplishments, and we're all about team. It's just about that experiential moment where we all are in the fire, and we're just loving it and just fighting for the ultimate performance.
The team-oriented approach may seem an odd fit in a sport where there's no such thing as an assist, but according to Roosh Vora, a senior who came to Trinity from Mumbai, India, it works.
We have a bunch of different countries, and we have people, you know, from all over the Northeast in America as well. And, you know, it's like a small UN conference, you know. There's South America, Brazil, you know, Zimbabwe, South Africa, Pakistan, India, you know, can't even name all the countries. The team hangs around with each other a lot. You know, there's never a fight on the team. It's the kind of camaraderie that is on the team is just unbelievable. I haven't seen this in my 12 years of squash.
Roosh Vora first heard about Trinity shortly after he began playing squash. He was 7. His brother preceded Roosh to Hartford and captained the Trinity team. On the international circuit, everybody who thinks he might like to combine squash with going to college in the U.S. hears about the nation's most successful program, and that's not the only way Paul Asiante finds each new generation of excellent players.
For 9 years, I was the USA national coach. I would take the men's team around the world to play. World championships in Cairo or Belo Horizonte, Brazil. So I developed relationships with the national coaches from all the other countries. So I would get a phone call from my friend who's the national coach in England, and he'd say, I've got a really bright guy here who's a very good squash player, and he seems inclined to go to university. Would you have any interest in recruiting him?
Sure, Coach Asiante might say, but tell him not to take anything for granted. He'll probably start out behind our guys from India and from Pakistan and our guy from Sweden, too, and maybe even the odd prep schooler from the U.S.
Rushad Kumara, Charlie Pasch, and Gustav Dieter are the captains, and our assistant coach is James Montano.
On January 21st, 2009, Trinity hosted Yale, at the time the number 3 men's team in the country. Roosh Vora, playing at number 9 that night, found himself matched with a freshman named C.J. Plimpton in what would turn out to be the evening's closest match.
Come on, Roosh!
Come on, Roosh!
Roosh!
Though he fell behind in 2 of the games of the best 3-out-of-5 match, Roosh prevailed, enabling Trinity to win the team competition 9-0. During that same season, Trinity, which has not lost a match since 1997, beat 14 other opponents by the same lopsided score. After the 4th and deciding game against Yale, Roosh discussed the advantage he'd gained by maintaining his focus when his opponent allowed himself to be distracted.
I think, you know, my head was in there all the time and his wasn't. You know, there were points at the crucial time he lost his head and, you know, that just comes with experience, so. He's a freshman.
The manifestation of Plimpton's loss of concentration came in his appeals to the referee. During a game, a player who feels his opponent has impeded him as he's gone after the ball can ask the official, in this case one of the other players, for a replay of the point. Sometimes the official agrees with the appealing player, sometimes not. Sometimes the player whose appeals are denied lose their focus. Sometimes they toss their rackets, kick at the wall, even open the door of the court to explain to the official just how blind he has been. But according to Roosh, Trinity players do none of the above.
Our coach doesn't let us do that at all, and that helps.
Doesn't let you display that you're unhappy.
We're not allowed to look out of the court and open the door and argue. You go home that day if you do that. So basically, you know, that's a big difference because you can keep your head cool. And if you saw every time he argued, he hit the next two or three balls he made on forced errors.
The unforced errors and the edge that experience provided enabled Roosh Vora to win his match 3-1. Each of his 8 teammates won 3-0. In 6 of the 27 games, the Yale players got no points at all, and Yale had been 8-0 before coming to Hartford. Trinity went on to win its remaining 2 regular season matches and breezed unbeaten through the playoffs to earn its 11th straight national title. But even with all his team's success, Paul Asiante says he doesn't assume the streak will go on forever.
It has to shift, and the streak will end. And I relish that day because coaches do a lot more teaching when they lose than when they win. I have 2 goals. The first goal is when we lose, I want it to be because a team came up to the bar. We wanted to establish that this is how good the game could be, and I'd like to think that somebody rises above that. And then my second goal is when we get knocked off, I'd love to go back and wrest the title back the next year.
At present, since that would require Trinity to lose, those goals don't appear to be within reach.
And the number one threat to America, zombies.
That's Comedy Central's Stephen Colbert summing up the sport that crept up on and creeped out college campuses just before Halloween 2008, and his description was surprisingly accurate.
According to Monday's The USA Today, the hottest new trend sweeping college campuses is humans versus zombies, a complex game of tag pitting humans armed with Nerf guns versus the zombies trying to tag them.
What more is there to say about humans versus zombies? Only a game's Karen Given was on hand for the conclusion of an October 2008 game at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and she survived, but only barely.
You know, no thriller? Everybody check your walkie-talkie. Make sure you're on channel 21.
Yes, I am.
21.
Darren Two Feathers, Tim Bain, Sean Coffel, and Alex Silver gather in the UMass Student Union 2 hours before the start of the final mission of the fall HVZ. They are humans versus zombies administrators and experts in obscure zombie movies, tying square knots, and in the case of Tim Bain, Nerf weaponry.
This is the Maverick. It's actually the most common Nerf gun. It's cheap. It's like $6-$7. You see it a lot. It's kind of cool to see what people do with different guns. There's so many guns, though.
Humans versus zombies plays out like any number of popular movies. Zombies try to tag or bite humans to turn them into more zombies. Humans fend off the zombies using Nerf weapons, clean socks, and fresh marshmallows. Zombie players must bite a human every 3 days or they'll starve to death. So Sean Coffel says they stalk humans in parking lots, outside dining halls, and between classes.
You know, I come out of French class with Tim. And we'll just be walking along by the Fine Arts Center, and we'll look off in the distance and see 3 zombies booking it after a human who's chucking socks over their shoulder as they go, things like that.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes you hear people who aren't even playing go, "Yeah, go human," and it's just great.
This semester, the game started with nearly 650 humans. About 25 were turned into zombies right away. Over the course of the next 11 days, all but 200 of the players have been turned to zombies, and all but 100 of those zombies have died of starvation. But Darren Twofeather says all the zombies will be resurrected for today's final mission.
You know, you see in all the zombie movies, tons of zombies and a few humans trying to fight their way out, and the humans that legitimately make it this far without cheating and have been struggling this whole time, using vaccines to stay human and fighting for, you know, their own survival, have really enjoyed the challenge. So they don't mind that there may be 200 zombies to their 10 humans. They are going to try their best to survive.
Oh yeah, there are vaccines too, which can shield humans from a zombie bite or turn a zombie back into a human. Almost everything in this game is borrowed from somewhere else. The zombies are of the quick-moving, bloodthirsty variety found in 28 Days Later. They're created by an experiment overseen by the Lazarus Corporation, a thinly veiled knockoff of the Dharma Initiative from the TV show Lost, and there are even nods to Charlton Heston's The Omega Man. But Keith Rude says even though the plot is not exactly original, the outcome of today's final battle is far from predetermined.
I guess since there's no real zombie invasion, you can't exactly say what would really happen and who should be winning. We try to say there's no winner in the game, but I guess if you look at most zombie movies, it ends with everybody's dead.
With just an hour to go before the final mission, the game admins scatter to four distant corners of the campus to set up their props. The weather, which started off mild, turns dark and windy.
You guys, this is the perfect weather for the scenario. It's like, you know, the zombie virus is in the air and there's like a huge storm moving over us. It's so cool.
On top of O Hill, between two large water towers, Tim Bain gets ready for the 4 o'clock start. To the casual observer, the mission objective looks like a wooden crutch jury-rigged to a slightly smelly trash can. But to human players Jason Mellon and Michael Reardon, it represents an overload switch at a cooling tower.
They've got four of these contraptions around campus, and the different humans have to go around each of them and hold down the lever for 5 minutes, and that's supposed to trigger the reaction. Try to take the zombies out and let the humans live.
If we fail, the virus will spread into the jet stream, and then, like, everyone will become a zombie. It'll be a huge breakout. I never knew UMass Amherst would be such an important site.
While Michael has enjoyed meeting his fellow players, fleeing from zombies hiding in bushes, and learning the ins and outs of Nerf weaponry, there's one component of humans versus zombies the freshman has yet to embrace.
I actually haven't used socks because I find that socks have sentimental value to me. So if I throw them, I'm going to want to retrieve them.
Humans! Lay down your weapons!
Michael might soon rethink his no-sock policy as a swarm of zombies approach the humans amassed on top of O Hill. Squad leaders call for the humans to hold their line while the zombies approach. As the zombies are hit by flying Nerf darts and socks, they move red bandanas from around their heads to around their necks to indicate that they've been stunned. Human players tagged by zombies move their bandanas from around their arms to their heads to indicate that they've been turned. A full flank of humans fall to the zombies, but before long, the horde is defeated and the mission objective is reached.
Next location, Zeds!
Webster, form up!
While the humans regroup and the zombies fan out to find more victims, HVZ admin Darren Twofeathers hops into his car to try to beat everyone down the hill for the next stage of the scenario.
They managed to start the meltdown, so now they've got to get to the camp center, which is where we're headed right now.
So what's in it for the zombies now? I mean...
Nothing. They want brains. They get a nice feast of brains.
A room in the basement of the campus center serves as the fallout shelter for the surviving human players. Liz Crothers' skin is flushed and she can barely breathe, but she's glad she made it to safety.
Yeah. Asthma attack and all, we made it. It was a little tense for a while. We got to the parking lot behind O Hill, started to go down the hill, and then we caught up with another group of humans. And then from behind us, it was zombies in the parking lot, zombies in the parking lot. So we basically sprinted here from O Hill.
Yay, you're alive!
After 15 minutes, the door to the room is closed and everyone outside is considered lost, either to the zombie horde or to the radiation released to eliminate the rage virus. While most players celebrate their own survival, a few mourn their fallen classmates.
Jesse didn't make it in!
And we lost Danielle.
We lost the pit crew, we lost Casey, we lost Jesse.
Pit crew had 15 kids, there are two here.
Daryl McTague is a junior who's been playing this game since it first came to UMass 3 semesters ago. He considers this installment to be a success.
Overall, I mean, we did blow up the Pioneer Valley.
But we won.
It's melting right now.
If the game were real, the humans would now be locked in this basement, waiting for the radiation to clear. But since it's only a game, Brian Rizza and Charlie Amonte are headed out for a celebratory feast at the Worcester Dining Commons.
We finally get to feast on Worcester.
It's usually completely overrun by zombies because they like to camp out the dining halls because that's where all the humans have to go to eat. So humans have been staying away from there for the past week or so. So now that we're free and we don't have to look over our shoulders, we can actually eat at the dining halls instead of scrounging for what food we have in our room. So
ramen noodles,
it's a
baby.
Feast. It really truly is.
No more noodles or Chef Boyardee.
While campus-wide games of tag have been going on for decades, Humans vs. Zombies was first created just 3 years ago at Goucher College near Baltimore. Today, the game is played on dozens of campuses from California to Maine and as far away as Australia and Brazil. And organizers are happy to say the zombie horde appears to still be spreading.
You got 2 minutes left till you're on stun! 3 minutes left in the barrel!
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given in Amherst, Massachusetts.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view our photo galleries, download our weekly podcasts, learn more about the music you hear on our program, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word is from zombies. Well, yes, but Pete Rose's argument for Hall of Fame inclusion is a little more nuanced than that, don't you think? I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.